In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions should not be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us. This is Modern Apocrypha. Hey, I'm Jared.
And I'm Greg.
This is Modern Apocrypha.
Welcome, everyone.
What do you want to talk about?
Indeed. I wanted to bring up the topic of natalism, which, for anybody that doesn't know, I should read a quick, simple definition of natalism. It's like a five-word definition, which is simplified down to promoting and supporting child rearing, the creation of children through natural childbirth, right? As opposed to being opposed to increasing the population of the world. So natalism is pro-life in the old world way of saying it, and reductions in the population, anti-life, is anti-natalism. So I thought that would be a good topic to bring up with where we're at in the country and what's going on with discussions right now.
Well, and to just to frame this as a general thing, the dark side of the dialectic, which is the World Economic Forum and the left in general, the woke crowd especially, tend to be very antinatalist. They are very much against increasing the population. They seem to have this idea that human beings are bad for the planet and that we should all kind of be gone, where we know God told us to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And we're not there. We could support 10 times the population we have now with the current tech and the way the earth is now without a problem.
Certainly. Certainly. I've never been one to think that we were running out of space or running out of food or many of the issues that we hear about. We've got some trouble in the world. We know that Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, places around the world are not taking care of themselves in a very good way. But I don't know that less people on the planet would change how they're treating each other, right? There's a disconnect in cause effect for these people.
Well, I'm probably jumping ahead here. I don't know exactly where you're going, but maybe I should save this bit. I will. So how about you lead out into whatever it was you were thinking, and we'll get into some of the thoughts on it later.
Well, sure. So on our side, we're obviously pronatalists. We advertise pronatalist companies. We are for pro-life and good lives for the humans of the planet. That's our position. And so we are pronatalists.
And I don't have seven kids for nothing, right?
Well, and I don't know that you can get away from even having one and not realizing the amazing benefit of the extra responsibility, the cross that you bear. I don't know exactly how you would want to think about it, but it's not an unpleasant cross. It is a life-edifying cross, right? It is a weight that you bear that gives you meaning in a way that is impossible to understand without having gone through it. I wanted to bring up the anti-natalist so that nobody thinks, oh, there's some crazy conspiracy that there's nobody out there that actually thinks this opposite way. So I bring up antinatalist as a word origin. Where did it come from? And it appears through easy to find information these days that Théophile de Gérard, and I'll include this particular document in the show notes for this episode, wrote what was in French, The Art of Guillotining Procreators, an Antinatalist Manifesto. This was recreated in 2006.
Let's just repeat that title. The Art of Guillotining.
Indeed, let me scroll.
Procreators, an Antinatalist Manifesto.
Indeed. Yes, The Art of Guillotining Procreators, and that is a very specific language because it's an art. You're going to need to get this just right for people not to be disgusted by it. And then it's guillotining, which is a type of murder where you turn the masses against the queen for saying let them eat cake or whatnot. So you're using the media essentially to poison the public to go after your enemies, and that's what guillotining kind of means. So this idea of the art of guillotining is the art of tricking the public into moving against procreators is a pretty telling way to condense the meaning of your title into the fewest number of words.
I got to be honest with you, man. This is one of those things where I would read something like this and I would go, oh, there are monsters in the world and they're human and they're evil. And we need to defend ourselves against them and our families because they're trying to kill us. And that's about as far as I would go.
Sure. And I would argue back just for people that don't feel like that is a sane and rational statement. This was rewritten in 2006 for the purpose of making it seem like it was a newfangled concept. But that was a rewrite of the same document that was written previously that I can't find the date of. And this is from the document, the beginning of position one. It's a chapter to denotation of this 85, 86 page document, The Three Pains. Right? And this is a quote that the author has tried to use to back up the antinatalist concept. And this is backing up my concept that this has been around so long as to not be a recent concern. So the quote he has here is, they say that there was a race of men tried upon the earth once, who knew the future better than the past, but that they died in a 12th month, so they died in a year, from the misery which their knowledge caused them. If any were to be born too prescient now, he would be culled out of natural selection before he had time to transmit so peace-destroying a faculty to his descendants. This was Samuel Butler Erwan from England in the 19th century. So these ideas are fermenting and from Darwin's time on, where God is dead, we must kill God, we must do something that is against the past. And then despite being proven wrong over many hundreds of years, they still keep putting their heads up against this idea of convincing people that self-destruction is positive for the environment somehow. It's an old concept. 19th century is not new.
No, not new at all. I mean, this has been... I don't know. You know, we don't see specifically antinatalist language in like the Bible or that far back that I know of, as far as the enemies of good back then.
I believe that's the child sacrifice on the biblical scale. Well,
okay, so yeah, that's where I was going with that. Is I was going to say we do have that. I don't know whether that agenda at the time went so far as to say that humans are bad for the planet or that all humans should be dead or something like that. I'm not sure, but I know that killing babies for personal power has always been a thing to please the gods, to make the gods like me. I go sacrifice my child has been a thing as far back as written history.
Indeed. And to carry through what you might not notice if you weren't paying attention, for anybody that's new to a conservative bubble of information, you have that from Bill Maher, you have that from most news industries, you have that from the modeling agencies, you have that from Barbie, the movie, right? These sort of things are in your world, even if you hadn't noticed, very strong. They're out there.
Well, it's an influence from the left that, you know, it goes back a long way, but actually let's step on something here real quick. There is this notion among a lot of people who are sort of on the right, or at least who are not way on the left. You know, the Weinsteins would be a good example of people who aren't way on the right, but who also aren't way on the left, who would probably point to, and a lot of people in their quarter would point to, this Malthusian sort of idea that too many humans are going to destroy the planet as being the source of a lot of that rhetoric, a lot of that thought process. And I actually want to step on that a little bit, because really that was a justification, not the origination of an agenda. And so what I mean by that is that the left has had this notion of destroying people. And it's because this is the enemy's purpose on Earth, is to destroy people. But this has been a part of their agenda for a very long time. Like we were talking about the human sacrifice thing, though that I think that's a little different. But the idea here is just that this is not the Malthusian population problem has been...
Isn't familiar with the word. What do you mean when you say Malthusian?
Oh, gosh. I'd actually have to look this up. But there's an agenda that has been present in academic circles for probably 150, 200 years now. That is, I'm actually going to have to look this up. So, the name I want to say is, let me see if I'm right about this. I think it is Paul Ehrlich. Yeah. Okay. So Paul Ehrlich, who was born in 1932, sort of did a lot of work in the direction of saying that we are overpopulating the planet. And this is an academic notion that was sort of built on the agenda of Malthusianism. And Malthusianism is a theory that dates clear back to the late 1700s, where Thomas Malthus laid out his particular view of things. It's the theory that population growth is potentially exponential, and that you're going to run out of food. And so you increase in population until your living standards decline, at which time it triggers a sort of a population decline, and then population grows again. And so you keep running up against the top end of this imaginary growth curve. This is all imaginary.
Wasn't it based on bacteria in a petri dish or non-humans?
Oh, you know, this is a very common thing for... Sorry, I'm going to have to back up a little bit. So where it comes from is the fact that any food-eating creature that we observe on Earth, whether it's rabbits or deer or bacteria in a petri dish or anything else, will increase to the limit of its living capability, to basically until it exhausts all the resources available to it. And then it will you'll have this huge die-off because it's exhausted all the resources available to it. And so when you put God out of the equation, you start to assume that this is true of humans as well. And as if you have a Christian view of things, and there are certain more secular people that are starting to wake up to it, like Elon Musk, who actually sort of realize that, no, actually humans, when we have more and more people, we create more and more people to come up with new ways to create food, to come up with new ways to sustain the population. That it seems like the more people we have, the more people we can support, because we have this drive to improve everything around us and to improve our ability to survive in difficult circumstances. And I actually think that that's 100% correct, but I'd go a step further. I would say that God knew that, and that the fact that other organisms in the world will have these die-offs if they're left alone to consume the resources is one of the reasons that God set us in charge of the ecosystems of the world, to take dominion over it and to sort of bring it to a place where we are stewarding it instead of just letting it destroy itself over time. You know, one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that the Indians spent a lot of time burning forests. The American Indians spent a lot of time burning forests.
It's a complete tangent, but I was interested following some of the biblical geneticists that have found out that what we call American Indians are the same race and the same people of the Mongols that ran across the world and killed everyone on horses with silk vests and stuff. Those people are all all the way to America and killed the original American Indians. And so the people that we came and killed, or rather, the Catholics came and killed in America, were actually the Mongols, because there were no American Indians truly left.
Well, we didn't actually do a whole lot of actual killing. There was not, and this is actually an interesting sort of, it's a side note, it's a rabbit trail, but you know, we didn't actually kill off a whole lot of Native Americans. There were a number of massacres. There were a number of really bad situations, and I'm not downplaying that, but really what happened was we brought diseases over here that killed a huge percentage of the population, and we ended up sort of poorly treating a lot of the ones who were left, as is sort of the case with human history in a lot of ways. It's not a new thing, but this perception that we had a genocide of American Indians when the white settlers came over really isn't the case. It was way more complicated than that.
Indeed.
Not to say there wasn't plenty of bad stuff, but
that
anyway,
one
go ahead.
Tangent. I do have something back on the natalist argument. Of
yes, please.
The M word of the way that they were looking at humans as a petri dish bacteria would not even play out with old science now, but older or newer science than his time when we did what was called the mouse utopia experiment. And that that proves that mammals and intelligent beings, or, you know, higher level thinking beings, don't act like bacteria. And it also kind of makes a point that trapping a group in a cage, i.e. a city, is really bad for the psychology of that group. Those things were also proved in the Mouse Utopia because of the way that mice act when trapped in a space. And then you do get the population crunch because they can't expand. But we're not in a cage. I mean, they want to try to put us in a cage. But right, as long as we're not in a cage, then we're not a Mouse Utopia because we're not in a confined space. But they keep, again, calling back that experiment, ignoring that experiment when they talk about the petri dish, and then moving forward to somehow we're going to act like mice because we're trapped in a cage when we're not trapped in a cage.
This whole thing, it's one of those things that you run into when people assume that they know better than God, that God isn't real and that they know better than God. And when you do that, you wind up in these really bad situations. So yeah, you can look at that mouse utopia experiment, which was definitely fascinating. And you wind up coming to the conclusion that if you put a group or a culture of creatures into a, as you say, a confined space, into a trap, then what you end up with is a disintegrating social dynamic where you end up with a percentage of the population become essentially these, call them homosexual parallel mice in this experiment, where they became the pretty males that would not mate. You have the females not really mating the way they should, eating their young, things like that, just crazy stuff. And then trying to apply that to humans, as you say, it ignores the fact that humans have the capacity to almost infinitely expand our living capacity in a given area, given time and resources. We do it. It's like when you look at what the world could support with decent farming techniques, and I'm not talking about this fertilizer thing that we've been doing for a while where we dig up nitrogen and ship it around and use it to replenish soils we're damaging. I'm talking about the sheer yield that you can get out of a piece of ground using really good regenerative farming techniques. The yield per acre for something like that is truly tremendous. And if it were brought into the mainstream, the way the laws of industrialization work, we would get better and better and better at doing it, to the point where we could do much more than we're already doing there, faster and with less effort, to the point where you could raise twice as much food on the land that we're using as we do now on our most productive ground, because that's just how humans work. We just make things better. That's one of the things God designed us to do. So you talked about Bangladesh and some of these other countries that are pretty messed up.
They're having a hard time right now, for sure.
Well, and what I would say is that in every case where we have a resource shortage, it tends to be a social problem rather than a resource problem. It's a thing of some humans get in control of other humans and damage them rather than, oh, we don't have enough resources. Because I've never seen a circumstance where humans on Earth didn't have the resources they need. A society didn't have the resources it needed over a good period of time, especially when you get some of these modern technologies introduced into some of these more difficult societies. It's like, I'm guessing if you were to go look, and this is something that I've actually sort of been, I've known this for a long time, but it's one of those things that's really hard to get people to understand without sounding racist or something. Most of the first world economies are not first world economies because they're lucky or because they're they somehow got there first. The way it works is your ideology, what you believe determines how good your culture is, and the positivity of the culture allows you to advance technologically and resource use wise to the point where you can do things better. If you take a tractor and you take it to Africa and you run it there, you only get to run it for so long before it breaks down and they don't know how to fix it because they haven't. Another example, and actually this is a very personal example. Back when I was working at the last job I had, there was a customer that was in Honduras, and we were providing them equipment. And this customer had access to American expertise and engineering and support for their product. And we were more than happy to teach them how to use the product, to show them how to do it in such a way that it would last for a very long time, and that if they did it right, they would not need replacement parts. But what happened was they abused things so hard that we would have to send them twice as to three times as many replacement parts as any other customer we had, not because of anything except the fact that their culture was so disgusting and destructive to things. They just ran things to death all the time, didn't stop for maintenance, didn't stop for cleaning, didn't oil things, didn't grease things, didn't take things apart and do the routine maintenance that was required to keep them running, which would make the machines more productive during the time they were running. So it was a case of they were shooting themselves in the foot every step of the way, and it was a cultural problem. The reason that most of the world has problems like Bangladesh and other places like this, it's all cultural. It is not resource, and it's purely the fact that the cultures are screwed up. And it isn't something where you can just teach people something and have it work. It's a case of the West has a Christian influence in it that has trickled out into all of society and allowed us to create what we create. It's all because of God's hand on us. It isn't because of anything else.
It is interesting. Something I've noticed in that space of identifiable concerns about a society. If you hear what's going on in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh and places that things are not going so great, it's a lot of what's wrong with you guys? How come you guys stopped doing what you were doing? External view, external view, external view. Whereas as much as we complain about ourselves, everyone, right? Everyone complains about America, even Americans. We're looking inward. It's an inward look in our thought process, and I think societally, and I think that hits a marker that whenever these societies are always pointing out, they're never doing it themselves. They're never going to do it themselves unless they start pointing inward.
I think you're right. And I think that whole thing is again an outworking of a positive worldview, of a positive sort of, Christian way of looking at the world that we take for granted now. And when you go to places where that is not the case, it becomes obvious very quickly, and they can't even keep up the machines that they get, much less create good new machines, without importing worldview and culture from places that are capable of doing it. And so it's a very interesting problem, but you know, it also comes back to something, a comment I made to Mary today. I was thinking about it and I said to her, you know, I think that without the direct interference of the enemy, of spiritual powers and principalities, that the whole world would actually slowly get better and better, that what Jesus did and the spreading of the gospel and the spreading of the Christian culture would actually be enough to overcome sort of the social entropy that we're talking about.
I can imagine ways that it will end up that way. I'm not going to put a future scene perspective on that. And certainly, I expect that that's where we'll end up. That everything will be in Jesus's way. that's our perspective for sure.
Well, when he returns in the flesh, we know that's the case, right?
Sure. In that societal makeup, what's pro or anti-natalist in those spaces? Because I see an anti-natalist perspective when there are lots of babies being made, just being made to sacrifice, because, you know, bombers, jihadi bombers need new babies. So there's a pro-baby anti-natalist, and there's an anti-baby anti-natalist. And so as the society...
Yeah.
As the societies are defined in that way, for a pro-natalist to be a pro-natalist, it's not enough to make another human sacrifice. You need to make a freestanding, successful, propagating, right, making more than it takes in human. You need to make a good human. Right? I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
Where the pro-natalist line is not just cranking out living beings, it's taking care of them too.
Well, that's certainly true. How about we take a break now, and when we come back, we dive into that a little more. How's that sound?
I think that's a great place to take a break, yes.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll be back in a minute.
Hello, Modern Apocrypha listeners. I'd like to take a moment to lift up North Arrow Coffee. If you're like me, you enjoy quite a bit of coffee, and North Arrow has a lot of really good coffees. But they're also following their very own North Star to support pro-life organizations. At North Arrow, 15% of all sales go towards life, not just for a limited time, but for a reason. So, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can use the code E6 at the North Arrow web store and save 10% today. Thank you.
As you can probably tell from the backdrop, there are new things happening here. This is my new sound studio for recording audiobooks. It's not quite done, but it's done enough that I can record an ad in it, and that's exciting. I also have an anthology that I'm just finishing now. It should be coming out real soon. I have book 2 in the Bright Star series is basically finished, other than some professional edits and the publishing, and I'm pushing on that pretty hard. I'm hoping that there will be news on that one in the near future. When it comes to audiobooks, I'm planning on recording both the anthology and Bright Star. And folks, I need support and help now more than ever. Bright Star is doing just fine. I'm perfectly happy with it, and I am expanding both my ground game and my marketing game, and things are just growing. But the best recommendation is a recommendation from a friend. So if you like what you see on Modern Apocrypha, take this as a recommendation to you. Bright Star is worth your time. And if you've read it and you like it, recommend it to somebody. Help me out getting the word out about this series. And be on the lookout. More's coming soon. Energemetrix6.com, E6universe.com, promo code Israel, 10% off. And we're back.
Welcome back, everyone. So you were in the conversation. We were on how a good pronatalist mentality will produce people, and people are, you know, self-governing individuals that have strengths and intelligence and tools offered to them, as opposed hopefully, at least given the opportunity as best we're able. Lead a horse to water. And then you have the other side of the way of having children, where people say that people did have children in order to be workers on the farm, and people do have children in order to have more vest wearers for the jihadis. Like, having a child to exist as a tool is not natalist, not Christian, not appropriate. But sacrificing of yourself to create a new line, a new free-thinking opportunity because of the trust that, I don't know, you could pick a million Bible stories where the prodigal son did something unexpected, and it wasn't what father asked for, but it was what father needed, and what society and the nation and God needed, right? So the space of creating a human for a human to be a human, as opposed to creating a tool to use humans as tools, is the big difference in pro-population anti-natalism versus pro-population natalism.
And I just look at it as outworkings of two different basic worldviews. One of those worldviews is a God-centered worldview, where we look at the command God gave us to be fruitful and multiply as good. We look at what he says about babies in the womb, how he knits them together, and children are a gift from God. They're a reward from him. He never, ever in the Bible ever says anything negative about having kids, about raising up a family. And so when you say that people had kids to have workers on a farm,
people say.
Right. I know. And what I'm saying is that I'm sure in some quarters that might be true, but among our forefathers in America, that was never really the basic worldview. The basic worldview was God made us to be fruitful and multiply and to fill up this earth. And children are good, and we need to take care of them, and they're a blessing. And that anyone who is a good parent loves their kids and wants to do the best they can for them, and to bring them up better than what they personally were brought up, you know, the way they personally were brought up, to give them better tools, to give them a better life, to make them have. And that is a positive way of moving. And it is just all of one piece with a Christian worldview. Then when you have a non-Christian worldview, it's always going to wind up somehow negative, whether it's that kids are a tool of some sort. It's like the way you hear Elon Musk talk about people. It's like, oh, we don't have enough people because we don't have enough geniuses, because, you know, if we had this much higher percentage of people, we'd have this many more really smart people who would come up with really smart ways to improve the world. Well, okay, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that notion, but it's still not a I care about these people based notion. Then you can, from there, you can devolve in any number of ways, whether that's devolving to using kids as cannon fodder or moving bombs or using them as, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Terrible ideas of replacement parts for people or things that you got.
Sure, of course. The point is, though, that you've got two different paths, two different worldviews in life. One of them leads to goodness. One of them leads to life. The other leads to darkness and death. And there are a million roads to get to darkness and death, or as the Bible says, Broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many will find it, and narrow, straight and narrow is the road to life, and few will find it. And, you know, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, yeah, there are a lot of ways to go down dark paths, but there's kind of just one very specific view of life that makes it worthwhile, and that is children are a gift from God. They're a reward from Him, and they're beautiful, and they're wonderful little people, and we need to love them.
1,000%. On the having children versus not having children concept of natalism, the Bill Maher view versus the fatherly view, how can a logical human come to the conclusion that I want more, there's no limit to what I want, and so I can't share with my own children in order to have them? I don't understand how that level of selfishness can be seen as a moral good in the non-child-rearing mentality.
Well, it's the idea that my personal pleasure and what is pleasurable and easy for me is good for me, and thus not bringing children into the world makes my life less difficult, and so that is a good thing, is sort of where all of that comes back to. And I know plenty of people who have that view. There's one who's coming to my mind right now who I really appreciate him as a person, but that particular view of things has managed him to get him all screwed up. He doesn't have any kids. He has no legacy, he'll retire and he'll grow old and die, and he has sort of decided that's his path. And short of actually inviting God into his life, it probably is his path. And it's really sad.
Well, that's really an entire nation. We know that South Korea right now, the feminist left has taken over such a large proportion of the females, and the Andrew Tate side of the manosphere has taken over the masculine side of the country. And so they won't even talk to each other, and their birth rate is such that they might not exist as a country in 15 years. And they don't care. They'd rather die than get along.
Well, and this is another sort of fork down that dark path, right? It's like, you know, when we look at the Andrew Tate part of the manosphere or the super feminist left, we see the same fingerprints. It's the enemy's work on both ends of things. And it doesn't mean that there aren't valid points to be made from any given perspective, right? That everybody has some sort of truth that they can contribute. It's like Andrew Tate is generally a proponent that men need to be manly and strong. And there is value in that perspective. There's a whole lot of other crap he has to say that's really stupid, and don't listen to pimps, because that's all he is. He's a glorified pimp, and not even a real pimp, just an electronic pimp.
Yeah, just a real pimp. No, he's had women in his house that he smacked for not being appropriately subservient. So
right, he's right. No, what I'm saying is he's not even a pimp who's pimping out women who are doing physical services for people. He's just an electronic pimp. He pimps out women to do cam girl stuff. And if you can think of a more contemptible, disgusting sort of place to make your money than that, I would be interested to hear about it, because that's just gross. And then on the left, you know, the fruit of the feminist movement is becoming absolutely clear in Western society. There is no way to say that it's a good thing, but on the other hand, the idea that we should treat women like property is obviously screwed up and bad. And so there's that, right? So yeah, there are different things that are true on both of these hands, but really, it's a case of the enemy has managed to create these narratives and draw people into these narratives to destroy society. And so if you draw the women into a feminist narrative and the men into a sort of a far manosphere narrative, you wind up with exactly what you talked about in South Korea. And it's sad. It's tragic.
Tragic. I believe, yeah, just painful as a Christian to bear witness to seeing an outcome that is just unnecessary.
Unnecessary and obviously intentional in some quarter. And it's evil. And it's where we see spiritual evil a lot of times is by its fruit. And the fruit there is pretty special.
Let's take a moment and talk about the fruit. What are some of the other anti-natalist things that you might fight against other than pure abortion or abstinence till death, etc.? What else do you see out there that are obvious things that are anti-natalist?
Well, I don't put a lot of thought into that sort of thing. Instead, I think about the way we should live, what we should do, because that's hard enough, right? So for me, in my life, I can tell you what my experience has been. I grew up, I did not expect to have kids. I did not expect not to have kids. When you and I first met, I hadn't really arrived at a conclusion. I was just a young guy who was getting started in the world, and I didn't have a goal exactly, but I had convictions about the way I was going to live. And one of those is God makes babies in the womb. And if you destroy an embryo after the egg is fertilized, if you destroy that in a woman's body, you are destroying a life that God has created. And that is wrong. And that is what has led me to have 7 kids, to be perfectly honest with you, because I love my wife. And I do not feel comfortable I don't feel comfortable manipulating my life to avoid having children. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I think that's against what God has told us to do. And so what I do instead is I trust God to do what he's going to do and to provide for me and my family and to take care of us. And I end up having 7 kids, 6 with one on the way still. We don't actually have 7 yet, but anytime we can actually have the baby now anytime. So yeah. And that's, it has been a blessing at every step of the way, but there are lots of things that I fight against in that path. One of those is the fact that I like having time with my wife, and having an itty bitty baby around all the time is not easy because you don't really get time together. You always have this other little person who's getting in the way, and that's not a comfortable thing. And then there's the whole, oh, we barely have enough food to feed ourselves. We can't feed kids. Well, gee, you think I don't know that? I got lots of mouths to feed, and some of them are growing up to be teenagers now, and that's not an easy thing. And so
pounds of food.
right, absolutely. And it's just getting more so, and that's okay, because I trust God. If I didn't trust God, there's no way I could do this. And so again, I have enough difficulty just learning to trust God and choosing to trust God and the choices that I've made and moving forward in directions that are good directions, that's all I really have focus for. I don't really have time for the people who, like, I have a cousin who, actually, the same cousin who did the book cover for Bright Star. The girl who did that was working before she did that book cover. She was working at a place where she was daily exposed to this person who was expounding against breeders, against people who have kids, against, we have this population problem. We shouldn't be having kids. Oh, can you imagine, just this constant nastiness. And I don't need to go looking for nastiness.
Sure. And it does kind of present itself as nastiness in the hindsight. The points that I had in mind whenever I thought about it, and let me know if this doesn't quite line up in your mind or not. The obvious one right now is the transgender sterilization. You call it one thing, but you're really sterilizing. That's anti-natalist, because you're allowing people to sterilize them, right? I would put the Rolling Stone lying article about football players mistreating a woman in college. That was a lie. The whole story was a lie, right? And that was set up to discourage people from getting along and getting into to couplings, right? This is everything you can do to stop people from reading through lies.
I mean, sure. I don't have any argument with any of that, or the abortion thing, or, you know, there are a million ways where we thwart the good that God would put into our lives in some way. And another one, actually, you know what I think the most antinatalist thing in modern history has been is this sex without boundaries thing. Because when you look at the fruits of that, it doesn't actually provide good, healthy, stable families. It provides these broken, destroyed messes where you wind up with people with totally fatherless homes and cultures where people are killing each other in gangs, and it is really, really bad. So, sure. No, I think that is the most antinatalist force in the history of our culture, is this free love idea, where it ain't free, guys. If you it's built to be done in the confines of a stable relationship. That's how it's supposed to be. And outside of that, it's destructive.
Sure. Absolutely. One other example that I've seen out there from credit where credit was due is Wendy.
Heather Hayne.
Heather Hayne, thank you. Heather Hayne had brought up a specific topic that I would credit her for, that they have children, right? They've existed in America. They've got children. And on the one side, they're not allowed to sit outside of a bar on the street and have a mimosa or something with their children existent. Right? The children aren't allowed to be and allow parents to be normal people. But you are supposed to take your kids to a gay pride parade and watch a guy in a bondage outfit walk half naked down the road. And you're supposed to take your kids to the gay parade, but you're not allowed to have your kids see you celebrate. Right? That's another place where it just happens.
You know, it's one of those things where the rules around the use of alcohol come from before the time when we had this sort of libertine culture. And the libertine culture is, you know, I'm pretty sure the enemy would love to have people drinking around their kids. I think that this super rules-based mentality where, oh, I can't be a responsible adult and go to a bar and have my son sit next to me and have a drink is stupid. I think trying to control people so that they make choices that you think are good choices instead of allowing them to make choices and then hopefully having them grow up to be an adult and make good choices is stupid. But just in general, the reason we have that dichotomy right now is that the rules from that time are all from before, where now it's this woke sort of Ishtar inspired segment of society that's trying to push this on us.
And we are running out of time for this episode, and I wanted to take a chance to brag about my kids. But to give anybody that doesn't have children, hasn't taken that step yet, isn't sure if it's right for them, we're both fathers, we're both pro-natalists, we're both for finding one woman, settling down, and building a family. Why are you what good have you experienced? Why are babies so important?
Well, it's two things, right? Number one, I guess you have to start from the perspective that this is what we were instructed to do by the creator of the universe, and that he had good for us in that. And the good is, number one, these are beautiful human beings, and you get to see them at their most beautiful stage. I have an itty bitty little guy right now who runs around just jabbering like crazy. He's an absolute parrot. I told one of my other kids today that when this baby was born, all the cuteness in the world just sort of condensed down into him, and there isn't any left anymore because he sort of got it all, at least for a while. And that's sort of the way it is. It is absolutely precious. Until I had kids, I didn't like kids. Until I had kids, I didn't like kids. Now that I have kids, I like kids. that's me as a guy with a very sort of, you know, big picture focused mind telling you one of the benefits of having kids was that I now like kids, especially because I like my kids. And the other thing that I would say that is the biggest one for me is it has changed my view of the world just sort of by default. I don't even know how to explain it exactly, but having kids gives you a perspective and gives you an internal drive as a man that is not there without them. If I didn't have kids to provide for and kids who were going out into the world to try to work to make the world a better place for them, I would be a much more selfish person. I would probably still be playing video games somewhere instead of trying to write, you know, good fiction to support my kids' generation, trying to put out this podcast to talk about things that matter. I would not be doing these positive things because these things we're doing, they're difficult. They're hard, man. It's like at every single step, I had one of those things happen today. This little cute little guy knocked over a couple of doors I'm working on and broke one of them. And this door, I've like got like $250 in the door and, you know, 2 weeks of work and all, just all kinds of, it sucks. It really sucks. I'm not sure I can fix it. I'm going to try. But the fact is, at every step, this is hard. At every step, this is challenging and difficult, and it's a grind, and it's important, and it's beautiful, and it's good. And that is the biggest thing that kids do for guys, is they push you to do big, beautiful, important, good building things. If you look at who the most productive men in society are, it's the men who have kids. And it's because they build to support their children. It's because that having those kids gives them the drive to do important things. Does that answer your question?
Oh yeah, that's a great place. And it's really the same point that I would make. I'm a pretty passive guy. I'm not someone that's going to get in people's faces or that sort of thing. And the extra oomph of having a reason to stand in the fire, right? Seeing that it's the right thing to do is not the bravery or the commitment or the pride that I get to be the one picked, right?
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's a good point. It does. It creates that motivation. And it's also one of those things, you know, there are two things in life that I know. Well, actually three. Three things in life that are totally unexplainable. Number one, meeting the master of the universe, meeting the creator, and having a real active relationship with the creator is not something that is explainable to someone who has not done it. You could explain little pieces of it here and there, but you're always going to end up with a blind man and the elephant sort of a thing. It just, you can't tell people what it's like. You have to try it. And you should, if you haven't, like, talk to him, ask him if he's there, tell him to prove himself to you. He'll do it. No question. Okay. Second thing, getting married. There is nothing in the world that prepares you for being married. There is nothing in the world that is like being married. It is not something you can explain to people. It just is what it is. And it's an incredible experience, okay? Then having kids. Even if you've done the other two, there's still nothing that can teach you what having kids is like. There's just nothing.
There's one more out there that you'll hit in a while, and that is when you're finally alone and your parents die.
Gotcha.
It'll be there. My father's had some strokes. He's not there. So.
Yeah. And I, you know, again, the things that you can't understand until you get there are things that you can't understand until you get there. I'm not claiming I've seen it all. These are the three that I have experienced.
Sure. So that's about our time for this episode. Anything you'd like to throw out there for people that are still on the fence about whether babies are good for them or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that the first thing any of us has to do is to get right with God. And everything else is going to flow out of that. And if you haven't done that, then you're not ready to have kids. And you're not ready to do anything until you've done that, because you need to do that. But having kids is still a good thing. It's still a blessing that he gave to everybody, even those who choose not to know him. So it's
a path to meet him sometimes.
Absolutely, man. Especially when that responsibility of having kids hits you and you go, okay, something got to change here, because this is important now. This is actually important.
Yep. You feel the ball in your stomach and the nauseousness hits you when you haven't done something that you knew that you could have done for your child.
Or needed to do and didn't, or whatever. And even then, even when you have done everything and something goes wrong and you go, what is it that I could have done? Because this beautiful person is reliant on me. There's nothing like that. And there's no other way to bring people into the world in a good way other than that. Because kids need dads, kids need moms, that's how they grow up healthy. Without it, they don't.
Absolutely. I've got a bunch of work for child rearing and working with your kids as opposed to demanding out of them and seeing the goodness out of it. I think that's a whole episode in and of itself.
I think it is. And you know, the other thing that I would add here real quick before we finish is there's a lot of propaganda out there from the left about how those who are pro-life are only pro-birth. And once you're alive, they just abandon you. And I really want to speak to that real fast. It just came into my mind to do it. You know, there is no group of people in the world who do more, whether it's giving or work or effort or campaigning, whatever it is to support kids, than the pro-life right does in America. And that's bar none. You look at who the good adoptive parents, the good foster parents are. It almost all comes out of one particular area. It's like a huge percentage of it comes out of the pro-life right. If you want to know who supports mamas who are having babies, it's the pro-life right. If you want to know who takes care of kids who are, you know, fatherless kids or who are going to school or whatever, look at the people who are making the effort. It's the pro-life right. So, you know, people living that as part of your life is important. And people who are Christians just tend to do that.
I agree. So everyone, take a moment, love your children, give them a hug, right? Oh, God bless you. Thank you for listening.
And we'll catch you next time.
Till next time.